Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Tomorrow is Memorial Day, a holiday formerly known as Decoration Day, for the practice of decorating the graves of those killed in the Civil War originally with flowers and flags. One of the earliest events identified with this holiday occurred on May 1st, 1865 in Charleston, South Carolina, where former slaves exhumed the bodies of 250 Union soldiers from a mass grave and reburied them in respectful and proper manner in separate graves, giving honor and expressing gratitude to those who had died in a battle that helped these former slaves obtain their freedom. A year later, Waterloo, New York, had a day for placing flowers on the graves of soldiers in the village's three cemeteries. And the national date of May 30th was first proclaimed by the Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, John A. Logan, in 1868. In these words, "For the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion." Decoration Day later became known as Memorial Day, and increasingly an occasion to honor all war dead in the United States. It was marked on May 30th until 1971, when the last Monday in May was designated as the holiday. Now, in some places, it is not only the graves of those who died in combat that are decorated, usually with small American flags, but also the graves of all veterans, whether they died in combat or later. When my daughter was 11 or 12 years old, we visited the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts. We were on the adolescent daughter's Little Women tour to the Alcott house and all. And we went to the Alcott family plot in Sleepy Hollow and found that Louisa May Alcott's grave was decorated with the seal of the Grand Army of the Republic and a small flag. Now, Alcott was not one of the war dead of Concord, but the veterans group in that town had decorated the graves of Sleepy Hollow, apparently marking all veterans' graves and including her in that number because of her service as a nurse during the Civil War. Now, in a more innocent time than the one in which we live and before the Vietnam War, I remember Memorial Day as a community holiday with a large parade in which I participated first as a Cub Scout and then as a Boy Scout, and my brother as a Boy Scout and later as drum major of the high school band. It was the major community patriotic holiday of my youth. Not a lot happened around July 4th except fireworks at the fairground. Now, patriotism was simple in the 1950s. It was the Cold War era. It was us against them. But a major cultural shift took place in the 1960s. The war in Vietnam disillusioned many people, young and old. And that change was for me symbolized in a funeral at which I presided in the late 1990s for a Korean War veteran. One of his sons, a man about my age, spoke of the differing attitudes of generations. His father had been a Korean War vet. I was the officiating clergy. But the two sons and several friends spoke about Bill. And the older son, Stephen, spoke eloquently about how people of his father's generation did things without question, and that indeed some of these things were very good. But his father was a bit old-fashioned, as he put it, and did not take kindly to him growing his hair long and being, in his words, one of the first six hippies in New Jersey. Now, this was in a funeral home in Monmouth County prior to cremation, and we did not go to the cemetery. But at the conclusion of the service, the funeral director and his assistant went to the casket and carefully removed the United States flag that was on it and folded it exactly the way I'd learned how to fold it in Boy Scouts so that only the blue stars would show in a perfect triangle. And the funeral director walked to the widow Mary and said, "On behalf of the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense, and with the thanks of a grateful nation, I ask you to accept Bill's flag." I have attended or officiated at many funerals. I have helped with arrangements when family members have had difficulty making their way through the decisions and the paperwork. And sometimes when there was no next of kin for a member of the congregation, I made the arrangements. And often I have ridden in or behind a hearse with the folded flag in a triangle showing through the rear window of the hearse. But I've never officiated the funeral of someone killed in action, only veterans who died in later age. And I'd never before seen the ritual acted out. The flags had already arrived folded. And it was powerful. It reminded me of the memorial days of my childhood, but one more image from that funeral comes to mind. Following the service, 150 or so people present filed past the family sitting in the front row in the chapel in the funeral home. As the evening drew to a close, Stephen stood next to his mother, who was a full foot or more shorter than he. He was dressed in black, but unlike his father's business associates, not a black suit, but a black shirt, black trousers, black boots, a black bandana, and a black leather jacket. And standing by his mother, towering way over her, he was holding that flag under his arm. This image became for me a symbol of both the differences and the connections between generations, and how they view the world, and how a generation that has rejected, let us say, the simple patriotism of another, nevertheless cares and respects that generation and its actions. Now, the son is well known for his work in civil and human rights, and some of this work involves criticizing his country in ways that clashed with his father's attitudes of my country, right or wrong. But it has not always been simple. Perhaps it's never been simple, and there have always been conflicting visions. Louisa May Alcott, whose grave my daughter and I visited, was not only a nurse during the Civil War, but she was among the most radical of the abolitionists prior to the Civil War. She was a proponent of levels of equality between the races and racial integration that even many of the other abolitionists would not go for. She even encouraged the notion of interracial marriage. Later in the history of woman suffrage, Elizabeth Cady Stanton equated patriotism not with the preservation of the status quo, but with the expansion of rights, lamenting that the virtue of patriotism, in her words, is subordinate in most souls to individual and family aggrandizement. The folded flag has come to symbolize for me the complexities of patriotism, not just because of that funeral, but because of another one. This for a member of my former congregation in East Brunswick, New Jersey. Trudy was from Vienna. She and her younger sister just barely escaped the Nazis. Like many Jewish immigrants, she worked in the garment industry here. And then she joined the Women's Army Corps so that she could go fight the Nazis. By this time, her first husband and her father were in a concentration camp. She served as a translator in Europe and was always proud of her military service. And when I first came to know her in 1981, she was active for peace and nuclear disarmament. Trudy embodied in her long and complicated life a complex notion of patriotism. She had become a U.S. citizen. She had finished college in the United States and was for many years a devoted school teacher and fired from several school districts because of her political activities and the absolutely uncompromising stands she took in support of her students. For a number of years, these were special needs students as well. She and her second husband had both been members of the Unitarian Society of New Brunswick before my time there, but had left in a dispute with a former minister. A very 1950s thing to do. Both were hard workers, devoted parents. She was a teacher, her husband an electrician. And they were both communists. In fact, at both of their funerals, and I officiated at both, we had letters from the Central Committee of the Communist Party USA to read. But there was never a cause related to peace, civil rights, fair housing, and the suburb of East Brunswick in which they lived, or issues related to the neighboring city of New Brunswick, to which Trudy and John did not wholeheartedly give themselves. There was not an issue of fair labor practices or treatment of students in the schools where she taught, for which she did not put her job on the line. John died 12 years to the day before Trudy, and she never stopped missing him. She came back to the Unitarian Society during my ministry there and stayed long after my departure. And when she died in 1997, the then current minister asked me to co-officiate at the funeral and memorial service. Now, riding to the same cemetery where I had officiated at John's burial 12 years earlier, my colleague and I followed the hearse with the folded flag in the back window. We were in the car right behind it. And both of her sons had spoken to us about how proud Trudy was of her military service and how she believed until the day she died that the Communist Party was the best hope for the working class in the United States. Now, in keeping with Jewish custom, she was buried the day after she died, as we had done with John, who was an Irish Catholic atheist 12 years earlier. And in keeping with Unitarian Universalist custom, there was a memorial service several weeks later, in which was standing room only, and in spite of my best efforts, went on for 3 hours. Her son Paul put together tapes of the classical music she had played as a young violinist and the folk music she had come to know through her younger son Jean, who was a rock musician. Jean enlarged to poster size old photos, including one of Trudy in her WAC uniform, which was set on a table next to her folded flag. Now, Bill, whom I had mentioned earlier, had a fairly traditional idea of patriotism, something like Stephen Decatur's My Country, Right or Wrong. And Trudy, though described by an attorney who was a friend and fellow activist as a liberal do-gooder, and he meant it as a compliment, was truly radical in her politics. She was critical of her adopted nation, which she had served in uniform, as she worked with involuntary groups, her union, her profession, the electoral process, and yes, the Communist Party. Very different was Harry, a Unitarian Universalist and a registered Republican. He had been a bombardier during the Second World War. His plane was shot down, he was captured by the Germans and held in the infamous Stalag POW camp. He survived, went on to a successful career in business. He was a gun owner and a hunter. And long before Columbine and Charleston and Sandy Hook, he also worked diligently for handgun control in the 1990s and the early 2000s before he died in 2004. And in 2004, not long before his death, he had joined a group called Republicans for John Kerry for president. Another complicated story that doesn't fit the stereotypes those of us with gray hair grew up with. One more veteran I want to mention is Malcolm, whom I knew very well. I was his minister for 9 years. He lived for nearly 6 decades after receiving a Silver Star in the European theater during the Second World War. and never talked about his war experiences very much. He is a telegrapher in the army, charged with receiving and sending messages to and from the front. His wife, son, and daughter would sometimes notice him tapping Morse code on the dining room table as he was thinking or brooding or something in their home in East Orange, New Jersey. Only when a grandson asked about his experiences 55 years earlier did he finally talk about them, but only to the grandson. Now, no white person was more committed to racial justice than Malcolm was. And when the city of East Orange, where he had virtually his entire teaching career and lived for more than 60 years, turned from being nearly all white to nearly all black, he and Connie, who shared commitments to justice and to Unitarian Universalism, refused to join the white flight to the suburbs. These are all examples of veterans who had complicated notions of patriotism, except maybe for the first Bill, who was pretty straightforward about it. Well, in its simplest definition, patriotism is the love of one's country. But love need not be blind. The image of a folded flag has become, for me, through these experiences, an image of an open-eyed, critical love of one's country. The political and progressive active son holding the flag of his more conservative father. The flag honoring the garment worker union, who, having escaped the Nazis, went back to fight them and continued the rest of her life to fight for her students' rights and for justice for all. The Unitarian, who was a Republican of independent mind, who did not walk in lockstep with the radical right. The high school teacher in New Jersey preferred not to speak of the horrors of war for more than half a century. It is a critical patriot that the poet Adrian Rich defines in these few lines. A patriot is not a weapon. A patriot is one who wrestles for the soul of her country, as she wrestles for her own being, for the soul of his country, as he wrestles for his own being. Now, for the members of Trudy's and Malcolm's and Bill's and Harry's generation, the Second World War was the good war. And it was a central defining event in the lives of that generation and those that followed. And for my generation, their children, the Vietnam War was a defining event, and it was not a good war. It was rather part of what, in Adrienne Rich's words in her poem, burned out our country's dream of innocence. And yet many members of the World War II generation came to see it as wrong. I remember being at a luncheon at a church in Boston after William Kunstler, the radical attorney, had spoken during the Sunday service, and a member of that church board, who is a carpenter and a union leader, were talking about each other, and they both served in the Pacific during the Second World War, and they were, these two radical leftists were trading war stories. Yeah, almost 40 years or more later. But they had become anti-war activists as well. And during the Vietnam War, you may recall that Senator J. William Fulbright, writing about the arrogance of power, said to criticize one's country is to do it a service. Criticism, in short, is more than right. It is an act of patriotism, a higher form of patriotism, I believe, than the familiar rituals and adulation. This higher form of patriotism, Fulbright knew, was not the creation of any one generation. It is part of the tradition that historians such as Howard Zinn, himself a World War II bombardier, who flew on the first raids that used napalm in combat, reminded us in that dissent and criticism is the essence of American democracy, and used his long teaching career to teach that to young people. And he was an influence on my campus as an undergraduate during the Vietnam War era. Many veterans of the Vietnam era have developed a critical patriotism and are among the opponents of the current unending wars in Iraq and Pakistan. And active duty service members and veterans of current conflicts include true believers and critical patriots. Vietnam War veterans were often badly treated. And one member of my family who served in that conflict conflict had to wait more than 40 years for the Veterans Administration to acknowledge the long-term health effects of his service. Today, we are much fairer to returning veterans, even if the current conflicts make no more sense than did the Vietnam War. Many have noted that since the second Bush administration, the second Bush presidency, we have been in continuous warfare for the longest time in our history. And without benefit of a congressional declaration of war. And regularly, there are still more young soldiers who do not speak being returned home to be buried. So on this Memorial Day, I want to honor those who died and those who survived, and those who fought and those who argued for peace. And sometimes it's the same person. And I want to refute those who argue that patriotism is a simple matter. One can love his or her country without agreeing with the policies of its government. And I know a number of active service military now who are critics, yet fastidious in performing their duties as military leaders. But what I want most of all is to be able to hope for a time when we will no longer see folded flags at funerals. That will not happen in my lifetime, I know. But I'll have to settle for this hope. May the folded flags remind us of an important part of each person's life who is honored with one, and of the moral complexity of that life and each one of our lives in this imperfect world. May it be so. Amen.